I'd like to welcome everyone to session 364, titled The 10 Things Donald Trump Can Teach Us About Joseph Smith. And I'm definitely looking forward to this one. Before we get into introductions, just some of the usual housekeeping items to go over. Please silence your cell phones, and please be respectful during the presentation and during the Q&A portion. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We hope you will also support the Mormon artists and vendors on Handcrafters Row outside in the corridor. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin for preparation for the next session. Okay, as I said, this is session 364, the 10 things Donald Trump can teach us about Joseph Smith. Trump's rise from outside pariah to the presidency of the United States gives us insight into the phenomenon of charismatic leaders such as Joseph Smith. A comparison of the two men can shed light on the nature of revolutionary leaders and what characteristics it takes or doesn't take to stage an inside revolution. Looking at Trump, we can re-examine some of the assumptions about the motivation, skills, and character of Joseph Smith. And our presenter, I don't know if he really needs an introduction, but John Larson has a BA in linguistics from BYU and an MBA from WSU. He is the former host of the Mormon Expression podcast, employed at the University of Utah. John writes and occasionally podcasts at johnlarson.org. And with that being said, we'll go ahead and turn the time over to John. Thank you.
Thanks. It's good to be here. Downstairs, I was walking in. I met up with Chris. Where's Chris? He's one of the most prominent, or a rising prominent scholar, somebody to pay attention to. And we both agreed that the last 2 years, for those of us who have studied, especially early morning Mormon history, have not been surprising at all. It's playing out according to script. And for those who have seen or studied the rise of demagogues in the past, we're hitting all the marks. So it's been very interesting to watch, especially from the focal point of Mormon history. So I kind of wanted to bring that out a little bit. I think the tendency is to want to talk about it in reverse to the way that I've put it. And we'll kind of come to that at the end. You know, what does Joseph Smith and how he rose tell us about the rise of Donald Trump? But I want to play that backwards. There are, in terms of intellectual theories and describing Mormonism, there's oftentimes competing theories that are contradictory but both useful, so they come out quite a bit. The probably the most notorious or most useful example of this is the loose versus tight translation theory of the Book of Mormon. Apologists will sometimes use the tight theory, which is that Joseph Smith, by whatever means he did to find the Book of Mormon, was being dictated words directly and straight from heaven. And there's some things in the book, like the reference to Kumlongs or whatever the hell they are, would necessitate that. The loose theory is that ideas were percolating in his mind, and then he put them into the language of his time and his paradigm. So when we see 19th century anachronisms, they're explained by the loose translation theory, which is Joseph Smith being the vessel of necessity put his own views in. They're both legitimate theories, but they're irreconcilable, and the complaint is that they'll be used simultaneously. We have the same problem with Joseph Smith. I have a paper I've been working on for like 9 years that talks about the seven theories. I believe there's seven theories of Joseph Smith that are all mutually exclusive, but people switch back and forth between them, and it's just not that sexy to work on it, so I play Minecraft or do other things. So someday you can watch that. But I think that this discussion here for the next hour is really on unpacking what I would call the enigma of Joseph Smith. And sort of to frame it in the most readily accessible terms, Joseph Smith is sometimes positioned as a farm boy who was barely literate, who didn't have any formal education, and therefore the great things he was able to accomplish cannot be explained by the fact that he was a farm boy. So we have to get to other explanations, which we'll address here in a minute. And that is juxtaposed with some of the facts about him. You know, we see from his oration, he had a prodigious, if not photographical, memory. He could rattle off Bible verses in multiple languages verbatim. And so these are the things that these scholars know about Joseph Smith, and yet we'll insist, you know, that he was a simple farm boy who knew nothing. So this is kind of that slushy, swampy thing of trying to figure out who the hell was this kid? How did he do what he did? How did he rise to create probably the most successful homegrown, in terms of American religions, maybe short of Pentecostalism, and continue to have the success of the movement that it has today? How did that happen? Is sort of the question. And so when we see individuals like Donald Trump rise, it's a great chance to look and say, well how does this happen? And that's what we sort of want to address. It's probably important to define our terms a little bit. When I use the word demagogue, I'm going to use the standard definition, which is somebody who appeals to popular prejudices and popular opinions rather than rationality. And I think that last point is the most salient, because religion is fundamentally and necessarily an irrational endeavor. When it is not irrational, i.e. the things that religion does are rational, it gets absorbed into the bigger culture. So whenever we talk about a religious movement, we are of necessity talking about something that's irrational. And that people like me sometimes beat them up for that, but we need to understand that that's part of the whole thing. But there is an element of rationality that plugs in. I've long asserted that you could, if you do nothing about religion, except its own teachings about the universe, its own cosmology, you could figure out when the religion was born. Because when the religion starts, they incorporate the cosmology of the time. So when you read The Pearl of Great Price, it is very consistent with common understanding of the universe, the heavens, given the time period it was written in. So you know, the difficulty apologists have is saying, well, it's anachronistic, yes, but it's not anachronistic for 1842, which gives them a certain problem. So when we look at these things, we have to take into account the time that the things came in and what was going on around and what was accessible. So these movements are not just a function of the person, but a function of the time. All right, let's one last thought before we start. Those of you in here who are very faithful, you're at a slight disadvantage. The reason is the history of Joseph Smith has been rewritten and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, so that what is presented in church today by official sources. Now, the apologists would say, yeah, but if you go down to Deseret Book in the back corner on the bottom shelf, there are a bunch of books by apologists that acknowledge the truth. They're absolutely right. That's true. But if all you ever did is buy stuff from the distribution center, there's a hell of a lot of stuff that you have no idea about. And you're getting involved in discussion. The missionaries tracted me out like 3 or 4 years ago, and it was painful just talking to them. I don't take any pleasure of these kids. They're ignorant. I don't take any pleasure in poking at them, but they just can't reasonably dialogue about their own religion, let alone every other religion. And we'll get to that too. So what I'm saying is some of this, that people are looking through this lens of the church filter, and there's a whole fascinating history, you know, of Joseph F. Smith burning books and Katie Carter throwing them away and all this stuff that happened that you have no idea about. So, but the problem is everyone around you does. So you're in a greenhouse thinking you understand what's going on and you don't. So I'm sorry. All right. So let's start at number one. I'm going to talk about the top things, the 10 things that he can teach us. First of all, the powerful myth of the great man. It is something that still dominates our academic discourse, our history books. I personally think it's a false theory. What it is, in a nutshell, let's go straight to the grandmother of all examples. Hitler, I believe, was a product of his time. If the man, in my belief, had not been born, the events of the 20th century would have played out much the same as they did, in my opinion. And, you know, we can argue about why that was and the movement. You know, the Nazis were only in power 12 years. Have you ever considered that? 12 years. And all of that thing that's still echoing through our lives today was 12 years of power, which should give us pause about the rise of movements that are short-lived. But the great man theory basically takes and says, really, it's individuals who are exceptional. And I wrote down some examples of this in our culture today. Tony Stark is, I can't stand that movie, it's kind of entertaining, but it's this idea that the CEO of a company knows how to do every job all the way through. And it's people like that who make things happen. Pecos Bill, do you guys remember Pecos? Anybody? Pecos Bill was the same way. Davy Crockett, right? Ben Franklin. These individuals who are born who can do everything. For believing sturdy Mormons, Joseph Smith is a great man. He's an exceptional individual who came along and was able to do exceptional things because he is that person. There's something about us in our DNA. It probably comes from like our primate past, the silverbacks, and sort of wanting to have an authority over the top of us that we love. But if they step out of that, we tear them down. I mean, this is what TMZ does all the time, right? They're bringing people up and tearing them down. I think that's not because we're assholes. I think that's in our genetics. And we like having the idea of a great man. It's reassuring. If Tony Stark is running the company, we can't go wrong because he can go to any division and tell those kids how to do it and fix it like that. And we really love that myth. We love the myth that there's one guy running the church and he's talking to God, or there's one pope, you know, who's the father of all the Catholic Church, and he's got it, and we can rely on that. It's a shortcut, and it's easy. And it tends to rise when we have really complicated stuff. I would say that Hitler is such a powerful metaphor because the things that were happening in the mid-20th century are really complicated, and they're really hard to sort out, and they still don't make sense to us. You can look at Germany in 1930, what a wonderful place it was. Germany in 1960, what the hell happened? What kind of shit sandwich is this? How did that come up here? Because this place has a great history and a great... They do invade people quite... I mean, we're not completely surprised by it, but it is a surprising thing. So it becomes a shorthand to identify somebody as a great man. The problem is once you do it, you imbue them with all sorts of power that they do not actually possess. You defer to them in many great ways. So right now, we have been living in a cultural transition period. The big cultural transition period started with industrialization, probably mid-19th century. We still haven't adjusted to that. But even so, post-war, post-cultural revolution in the 60s, we're still reeling around from that. We have not settled on our cultural values, on what it means to be married, on what it means to be a child, on what it means to be educated. Almost every aspect of our life and our culture is not static. It's in motion. That puts a lot of stress on all of us constantly. And to pick a savior, to pick somebody who's going to fix it, Hillary Clinton, Elon Musk, whatever name you put there, you're investing power in people who don't deserve it because nobody deserves it. And so once that happens, once you accept that somebody is a prophet, again, I think the best example is Tony Stark, Iron Man. I should say, I'm kind of nerding out. He's Iron Man. So then you accept that what he does is right, right? And that's a go watch Iron Man again from a moral play. It's terrible. Like, we're just supposed to do whatever this guy thinks he's going to do. That's the great man theory played out from head to toe. So I think when we look at Donald Trump and see that great man, especially as his ardent believers talk about him and express him, you see that going on to where there becomes a dimming of a view of the facts. And we'll talk about that in a second. Number two, the role of artifacts. This one is a short point, but I think it's very important. And it's something that kept me in the church for years, this one couplet. That whenever I was reading the Book of Mormon and something was challenged, there was an anachronism or something just didn't make sense, I'd say, yeah, but how did that poor farm boy write this book? The Book of Mormon is true because Joseph Smith wrote it. But when we reversed it, when we put that away and we ran into a problem with Joseph Smith, we would say, but he's a prophet because he wrote the Book of Mormon. How could he write the Book of Mormon if he wasn't a prophet? So we get caught into this circularity. But the circularity is fixed in the mind of the believer by the divine nature of the Book of Mormon. I have someone who works for me who was a Trump supporter. So it was the ninth, and we were all sitting around at a conference table like stunned, and she was kind of happy. So I said, well tell me, what is it? I mean, I really want to know. We were alone in the room. You know, I'm having trouble understanding. And she said, well, I read The Art of the Deal 6 years ago, and it was a great book. That was her whole reasoning. Well, what's interesting is Donald Trump didn't write The Art of the Deal. Matter of fact, the ghostwriter who wrote that thing hates Donald Trump with a passion and will talk to anybody. What's also fascinating is there's about 60 million Americans who do not know that this guy is out there talking constantly. That's the little glass bubble I'm talking about. But that role of that artifact, be it what it is, for Trump, it can be his empire, it can be his casinos, it's more likely his television show, quite frankly, and a persona that he's developed that speaks to his believers. But it's these artifacts. Trump can't be a buffoon if he's worth whatever $1 billion they're claiming at that moment. Trump can't be, he has to be a good leader if he's a good businessman, which is nuts on many, many levels. And we'll again get to that later on. So the role of the artifact is really super important, especially if it's an artifact that you can't read. Now, I'm going to say something radical. You can't read the Book of Mormon. Have you tried? It's mostly nonsense. It's really hard to read. And we'll talk about that more in a minute too. But if it's something that's in a museum that you can't examine with your hands, like Trump's empire, you know, and this is the big battle that's going on. You know, everybody's like, what's with Russia? And you know, the Republicans are especially saying, it's a smokescreen, it's a boondoggle, whatever. They're kind of right. But they know they're wrong, because what everybody's looking for are all the dirty dealings that is assumed to have happened between Trump and probably the Russian mafia, which probably got him involved. There's pretty good circumstantial evidence for this, like people who've said, yeah, I've seen it. So, but we're looking for that directly. Why is Trump doing all this stuff? In my opinion, it's purely opinion, is he knows there's a smoking gun in there. So his only move is to keep them out of that, because they're going to find something there and he knows it. And if you look at it from that theory, then everything he's doing makes sense. If you don't accept that, then it's kind of weird. Like, why would he be dismantling his whole administration over this? Because he doesn't want you to see what's in there. All right, let's go on to number three, the force of ignorance. Now, we use the word ignorant oftentimes in our culture today as an insult. I want to move away from that. We're not talking about stupidity. Ignorance is that we don't know something, not that we're incapable of knowing it. And this goes to something I hinted at a minute ago. The problem with our society that we all face is it's become really, really complicated. And, you know, in the old days, in the 18th and 19th century, even before, you'd get these gentleman scholars, you know, who would have money, and then they would go to Cambridge or whatever, and then they would discover the 34th element, and they would engineer a new pulley, and then they would make a new bridge building system, and then they would go and discover Oregon or something. You know, they would just do all that. That is closed down. Like, if you want a PhD in the sciences these days, you're going to be talking about stuff on the edge of human understanding that only a handful of people can understand. And I see this in the business world now. It's not that we want engineers or software engineers or whatever. We need highly specialized people who can do this, who are expert in this much stuff. So we're all awash increasingly in ignorance. The more society learns collectively, the more stupid you are. And that should give you pause and question. This whole thing about fake news, what's fascinating to me is I have not met a single person who doesn't believe, think about this, that they can read news, i.e. you could get on CNN right now and read an article that was published in the last 20 minutes, and you all believe you know if it's fake or not. That is scary, because both the left and the right are doing the same thing. They believe they can spot fake news without any reference to review it. I mean, the answer should be, I can't tell if that article is fake or not unless I review. Now, of course, they could pull something up that you know that particular element's fake. So highly informed people are better at it. But it's still a scary proposition. It's a difficult thing to do to identify fake news. So I just do that to underline again this this force of ignorance. And let's go back to the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon, and this is not my idea. This has been floating around at this conference for like 40 years. Because the Book of Mormon is confusing and oftentimes uses language where they've redefined terms, which is a trick if you ever want to write spiritual or complicated manuals to get like your PhD, which is you redefine common or confusing terms. So everyone's like going to the vocabulary in the back all the time trying to figure out what the hell you're talking about. So what the Book of Mormon does is it sounds spiritual. I once heard a presentation. It was given at Sunstone. I wish I could remember who. And the individual argued that the Book of Mormon has value to the believers because it's so hard to read, you fall into a meditative state when you're reading it. No, this is a serious argument. And I think it has legs. Don't laugh. So that allows, you're in kind of a spiritual frame of mind, and your mind starts to wander because what you're reading on the page is really hard to follow. So you can start getting insights. You know how people say, I can pray to God, open my scriptures to any passage and read it, and I'll get an insight? That's because that passage doesn't say anything. Because if the passage actually said something interesting, it would be proved true or false, right? But the passages that survive for millennia are the passages that are so laced in their own rhetoric that they don't say anything. I'll prove it to you. Go pick up a Hindu scripture, a Buddhist scripture, a Zen, and you're like, what the fuck are these guys talking about? I cannot. You're going to have to go read 10 books just to be able to read one of the books that the believers do. And that's because they're wrapped in their own language. And that reads to ignorant people, i.e. all of us, as spirituality. Because when we hear things we don't understand, oftentimes our first course of action is to assume we don't understand it, which is usually a pretty good assumption. I was looking for this thing. I can't find it. I read this years ago as an undergraduate. I had a rhetoric of science class. And they had shown that there were professors that their peers did not think very much of. But they were really confusing. They were really bad lecturers. So students would rate them higher because they're like, that guy's so brilliant, I can't figure out a thing he's saying. and for when you're ignorant about something, if a theoretical particle physicist came up and told you about the current state of affairs, none of us, we would all just nod. We'd have no idea what they're talking about. Well, I have an MBA. I'm not brilliant or anything, but I know enough economics for it. I can't stand watching the news when they talk about economics because they get wrong things you learn in a freshman econ course. And you have all these powerful people arguing about things they do not even remotely understand. Well, so what do you have with demagoguery? You have somebody, you have this, the real enemy of the state in demagoguery is the intelligentsia. They call them right now the dark state, the deep state. That's what the conservatives call them. What this is this band of technocrats who understand things that we don't understand. You remember about 10 years ago, 30 years ago, you'd go and tinker on your car, and about 10 years ago, there was a plastic hood installed over your engine. So you open that thing up, they don't even let you see what's in there anymore, right? There are people who see that and they feel a sense of relief, like me, because I shouldn't be touching anything in there anyway. There's another group of people look at that and it's a conspiracy. What are they trying to hide from me? Both responses come from ignorance. Neither of us know what's in there. We could, but it's a complicated world, right? So you have a lot of people who are voting in the United States who do not understand the basics of what's going on. Again, that includes you and me. And so we tend to frame up in camps. We tend to consume media that speaks to us. And then we start getting into a bubble. That is all something that happens because of ignorance. I'll give you a Mormon example to show how this played out with Joseph Smith. When I left the church, I decided I didn't understand Christianity, so I started studying Christianity. And sure enough, I didn't understand Christianity. An example is the way Mormons characterize the Trinity. When you hear Mormons talk about the Trinity, whatever comes out of their mouth is wrong. They have it dead wrong. As a matter of fact, I'll give you an example of the same thing in Mormonism. The Mormon position is that the God of the Old Testament and the God of half of the Book of Mormon is in fact Jesus Christ, because he was God, the voice of God, the God, without a body before he was born. Well, if you accept that premise, you go read the Book of Mormon. It doesn't make any sense. The same way the Trinity doesn't make any sense. So, and you have to use metaphysical explanations to resolve that. But we can go and raise whole religions on our ignorance of the Trinity. What happened in America, if you go to Europe, what you'll notice right away is there's a whole bunch of empty churches or great big cathedrals that have a tea shop in them. Because there were lots and lots of churches built out of stone. What happened in the United States is we outstripped the churches and the church's ability to keep up. So frontier religion grew because the church couldn't get trained pastors out in front of the people fast enough. That's where the American tradition of Bible reading came from. And of course, it's caused unknown. I remember in Sunday school as a really young kid, you know, they'd make fun of the Catholics for telling us we couldn't read the Bible. And now at 44, I see what a brilliant theological decision that was, because the Bible's full of nonsense, right? And it's contradictory, and it has things that don't support other parts of it, and that sort of thing. So this Christian tradition grew, and you had people who, because they were on the frontier and they were hard workers, they weren't going to catechism. They hadn't gone to theological school. They hadn't gone to Cambridge and, you know, learned their letters and learned about, they couldn't speak about the Roman influence on early Christianity and things that the pastor class of the Catholic Church and even the, you know, the Church of England and the Protestant churches, they all knew. So you could literally make up whatever you wanted, and if it spoke to the people out of their ignorance, again out of theology, it sounded good. And I'm not talking about the theological elements that Joseph Smith made up. I'm talking about the way the early church under Joseph characterized the especially the Catholic Church. The for those of you who don't know, the Mormon Church was heavily anti-Catholic till about the 70s. And it's still in the Book of Mormon, right? They haven't taken the passage about the whore of the world out of there, have they? But that played on the ignorance of these farmers, not stupidity, about Christian theology. And so you have a theology that was constructed basically as a counteraction to a straw man theology that never existed. And what does God say to Joseph Smith the first time they talk? He says, all the other churches are an abomination. Try to find me something that the Catholic Church has done that, theologically. I'm not talking about we haven't got to the Mormon Reformation and Counter-Reformation yet. But these things exist. The same sort of sleight of hand here and ignoring this and asking, this thing is metaphorical, we can't take this. Which we see in Trump defenders, right? They'll play all sorts of games on what is a metaphor, and this thing speaks for itself, and we're not going to comment on this. I've told this story before, but I worked at BYU Police, and it was after President Hinckley had spoken at BYU, and one of the sergeants came back, and apparently one of the students, I wasn't at the devotion, I was doing traffic control or something outside. President Hinckley was there, and a student had the audacity to ask the President Hinckley about evolution. And Hinckley said, I don't know. He just gave a non-answer, right? But this sergeant came back, and he was furious that they would have the audacity to ask that question. Why was he furious? Because that's the most interesting question to ask Mormon theology, right? It's the biggest, it's the single biggest question. And the student broached protocol, you know? You don't talk about the 800-pound gorilla. We all know that. That's the number one rule. Well, so this ignorance that comes up can be fed, and I hinted at the beginning of the discussion that there is an official theology that's published by the church, and that's what people consume, and it leaves them at a very weak position rhetorically, because their knowledge of the Catholic Church came from what they learned in Mormonism in Sunday school, and their knowledge of the Reformation, I learned about the Reformation in Sunday school, not really in school, really, until I was in college. All right, we've talked about ignorance enough. The diminished role of truth among believers. Movements can make, what we learned from Trump, really, that we can apply to Joseph Smith again, movements can make tons of errors factual errors, tactical errors, and whatnot, and still be successful. That once somebody has accepted the identity of a true believer, facts no longer matter. And the reason this is because we all have a kind of internal reasoning system. And we have our own internal beliefs and values. And what we do is we bounce everything we hear, everything we learn off of those. Every so often, a paradigm shift will occur in which you change your values. And sometimes those paradigm shifts can take years. You know, you see ex-Mormons who struggle in that space, some for 6 months, some it's 20 years. But they have to have those values. Well, once they've solidified their values, i.e. accepting Donald Trump as a great man, then evidence that he's not a great man is dismissed because it gets shown, put up against this mind rubric and says, okay, this article over here from this news outlet says that Donald Trump is not a great man. But I know he's a great man, so this must be false, right? And that effect grows. And what will happen is the believers, the true believers, will retract. There is one book I want you all to read. You're all getting out your pens. Eric Hoffner's book, The True Believer. We talk a lot about demagoguery lately, but what the news media tends to not talk about is the role of the followers of the demagogue, which we don't have a word for. That's what this book is about. Is not the demagogue themselves, but what is the characteristic of people who pursue the demagogue. And Hoffner makes a really excellent point that I've always believed, that the nationalism and religion are not a useful distinction. They function on the same principles. And we could spend an hour making the case for that. But it's a very interesting book, and it talks about that retreat from truth. And I'm talking objective truth here. There's a lot of stuff that we deal with Trump that is subjective, and liberals oftentimes now talk about these subjective truisms as if they're objective. But we objectively have Trump disagreeing with himself or saying one thing here and saying another thing here, saying something that's objectively not true. So that's what I'm talking about. And that sort of stuff becomes less and less important as one follows the demagogue. Because what the demagogue has is no particular ideology. So we're talking about Joseph Smith here. What's really fascinating is the history you all pick up on Joseph Smith usually sort of begins about 1845, which is the best place to start Joseph Smith history because he's dead. And he can't disprove it, right? We can say things about him that he can't disprove. The worst thing that could happen right now is if somebody were to assassinate Donald Trump. Because what would happen, given the history of these sort of things, is this core set of believers, the whatever 60 million or whatever there are, there's probably less than that, but it was 63 million or that voted for Donald Trump, is they would probably lose half of them. They would just forget about it. But there would be a core who would turn Trump into a prophet. And what we would see, and this still might happen, is that 40 or 50 years later, long after he's gone, the story gets told and retold. And then what would happen is these believers would come at you and they would have all these stories about, remember the time that Donald Trump chopped down the cherry tree? Remember the time that Donald Trump invented the stove? And you'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? That never happened. And they would say, that's exactly what they told me you would say. Because as the movement grows, objective truth does not become important for the identity. And movements are more about identity. I'm a Democrat. I'm a Republican. I'm a Mormon. I'm a non-Mormon. We identify with these institutions that, in fact, have fuzzy boundaries. The reason people want to talk about God, and I refuse to talk about God because no one's defined the damn term. I don't know what you're talking about when you say God. And it's the same thing. It's whatever we want it to mean at the time. And for believers, that my reaction to God is their reaction to what you and I would call news. So when they see things happening, it's all out there because it's outside of their identity. So the further the demagogue, and we see this in spades with Trump, what polls are showing is there, and the liberal media has done some disservices. They love to go to the Rust Belt, and they love to find somebody who regrets voting for Trump. they still haven't learned their lesson that they have to talk to more than these elites on the two coasts. I'll give my preaching on that word. The liberal elite thing, it was something I dismissed, and then I looked up Obama's cabinet. They all came from four schools. You have a PhD from the University of Utah, you graduate summa cum laude. You're not part of the liberal elite. So there is some truth in that. I think it's this much truth. But there is some truth in these things. But these guys start pulling in, and we all saw it with Mormonism. So what happened in the early days is there was no particular ideology. And as a matter of fact, the three witnesses, a big portion of the first members of the 12, they left the church. The church has a story of why they left the church, but you can read there. They it's not like they all just suddenly died. You know, was it Martin Harris said, "I didn't leave the church left me"? No truer words have been spoken, because the theology and practice of the Kirtland Church has nothing to do, basically, with Salt Lake City. And by the time Young had it moved over here, it was unrecognizable. This can starkly be seen in the Kirtland Temple, which was constructed and built, 37? The Nauvoo Temple was 42. Those two buildings and the practices and the attitude about those churches, separated by 5 or 6 years, couldn't show you more difference. So this early group was changing day by day by day. And who was left at the end of the three purges? It was the people who would follow Smith no matter what he said. So there is the theory of the great lie, right? Which is, when you rise to enough power, what you do is you tell your believers something that is absolutely, undeniably false. Think about the Millerites. The Millerites, remember, in 42, were waiting for Jesus to come. Jesus didn't come. They lost half their membership, and the other half doubled down, and they were unshakable. So with the great lie, which, by the way, Donald Trump in one of his ghostwritings claimed he uses, the great lie is you just say something so unbelievable that to be on board, you have, what's the term in the mobs, to make your bones? You guys know this means you've killed somebody, and they know it. So if you turn on the mob, they can send you up the river, right? They have the goods on you, so you're in. They don't trust you until you've done something really terrible, because then they know you're in, and you're not just a cop mole or something like that. The same thing happens with believers. You'll see these series of purges. We're going through one this week, right? And the people who stay on will increasingly just drink the Kool-Aid. And this happens in the rise of every movement, and we have it documented in the rise of Mormonism, of Joseph Smith turning against his folks who questioned, said, "Wait a minute, Thursday you said this, and now you're saying this, and these two things are not compatible," and they were out. And they smoked the group down to just the believers, and those are the people who trained the rising generations, right? So what you had in Utah is you had a bunch of poor folks, but if we take from the 1840s to the railroad time, you had mostly Scandinavians and English who were fleeing famine. These were ignorant people. They didn't know theology. And now you have a core cadre group of people who have been schooled by this group of people who have chosen willfully to reject truth. So we see that as the movement gets attacked more, it actually rises the belief of the believers, because they increasingly discard what's actually happening. So now what you have is people who will not watch anything but Fox News, won't read anything but Breitbart, and because they've accepted that those things are inherently untrue, because their truth has been redefined. And that's what's happening to the, we don't know where the Trump hardcore believers are going to shake out over the next 3 years. We don't know if they're going to look and say, "Wait, he's a demagogue. He just keeps telling us what we want to hear, then does whatever the hell he wants." Or are they going to just keep coming along with it? And you can already see the cynical Trump campaign anticipating this. Keep America great. They've already registered, right, for 4 years from now. And there are people who will have the exact same situation who will suddenly say it was really crappy before, but now it's wonderful, right? Even those of us who are panicked and become like Trump news junkies. I was thinking about this the other day. What has the Trump administration done that's impacted my life? I actually have an answer. I work in healthcare. I work with healthcare insurance. It's paralyzed the markets, I'll tell you that much. But my own day-to-day life has not been impaired yet. Nothing. I've seen nothing. But I read it as if I have cancer, you know? All right. This one is related. We want to talk about the role of loyalty as opposed to truth. And I mentioned at the beginning, religion is of necessity an alternative to science, because science is hungry, and science gobbles up whatever fits the scientific paradigm. So science is going to suck all the marrow out of religion. Now, when you start a new religion, you get to have that springboard effect that I talked about in the beginning. You get to inherit the cosmology and science of the time. That's why the longer we go without another religious revolution, and my estimation is the next 5,000 years, there'll be 20 more of them, big, Catholic Church level big. Because it'll take is a social collapse of society, kind of like we saw in Rome, and that the Christianity spread through the slave class, and you guys know the story. But we talked about belief and ignorance as the last two. Now we have loyalty. And what you see in Trump is this constant talking about loyalty. He uses the word unfair a lot. And the word unfair that Trump uses can be understood if you substitute it with disloyal. Whenever he uses the word unfair, what he means is disloyal. And disloyal to Trump, as we've seen play out in the past week, is absolute loyalty up and no loyalty down. This same thing happened with Smith. And you can see some of the early leaders, Sidney Rigdon is the great example, that in the same way Trump did, never got fired, but just went on without him and left him behind. That Smith, in the same way, oftentimes became paranoid about which leaders were loyal. And this happened more than once. It happened in Nauvoo. You guys know there was a big town meeting. The night that Joseph Smith skipped out of Kirtland, there was a big town meeting in the Kirtland Temple. And my claim to fame, my ancestor, Vincent Knight, threw somebody through the plate glass windows. It was rough stuff. I mean, we played it down, and we talked about him crushing the china. There were people who were tarring and feathering is not child's play. That was being done on both sides, right? And so what happened is the church had changed. And there was land speculation and money. We'll talk about that in a second. What it became about is loyalty. And so I was just talking about that with the believers. The people who are loyal are the people who are willing to suspend. The mooch, the guy who's just come in to listen to him talk now. He is talking to Trump through the press, and he's signaling. How many times in the past 8 days he said, "I love Trump"? Like 20 times. What he's saying is, "I am loyal," and that's what Trump wants, right? He wants absolute loyalty because there's nothing else. There is no Trump diplomacy. There is no Trump philosophy. What's the Republican position on trade? No one can answer, right? Because Trump has signaled both things. And there's so many things like this where you can look over the past year and you can see both answers. Smith did the same thing all the time. Does Mormonism have a hell? Circa 44 to 30. It has both. During the time Joseph Smith was alive, there was a hell and there was no hell. And they both existed simultaneously. And that is such a useful thing for believers because they can't be pinned down. So when your religion believes all positions, what does it trade in? What is it if it doesn't have a belief? What is Trumpism if there is no political philosophy behind it? It is only one thing, and Trump has it right. It's loyalty. It's loyalty to the in-group. It's loyalty to the crowd. It's loyalty to the position and whatever the king says. And this, we're looking at Smith, where very much happened. We're looking at Trump, where very much happened. This same thing happens all the time. I guarantee if you sit back and think about your office, you can think about power struggles going on there that are all about loyalty and infighting. Because loyalty becomes the only currency of the kingdom, right? Because look at the mooch. What is he doing? He's trying to retract everything he said in the last year. There is no concept of intellectual integrity. There is only loyalty. And that same thing played out. You know, one of the things that blew up Nauvoo is Smith owned the upper land and the church owned the lower land, right? So when Smith started positioning his land above the church land, the church had huge debts, which, you know, the stake president and the bishop and those guys were really responsible for. These guys started getting kind of saying, why are you, the prophet of our church, undermining the fiscal scheme that you yourself have put in place? What was Joseph Smith's response? You're disloyal. You're out. And that's the same thing we see happening now. In commerce and politics, the truth does not matter. That's an important thing to think about. And because politics and commerce is where most of our wealth comes from. So the majority of the wealth in this world is not based on truth. Eventually it can catch up with you. If you're drilling oil, you can lie on your permit, you can lie to, you can pay off scientists, you can do all this stuff, but ultimately your well's going to run dry. So you're going to run into reality at some point. But you can make an inferior product and still win the market. And the examples of this are all over. Lotus 1-2-3 was much better than Excel. WordStar and WordPerfect were much better than Word. And you can go on and on and on in marketing environments where, you know, the Pepsi Challenge. Remember when Pepsi in the 80s said, but people think we taste better. Why are we not Coke? Because you're not Coke. And that's just the way it is. So that role of loyalty, the reason I bring that up, commerce and politics, is because that becomes the currency by which things are done. So we fault the Trump administration for not paying attention to truth. But when it comes to money, what Trump knows, being a billionaire, supposing he is one, is that loyalty and commerce, you can manage those. Truth, you can't manage. Why even worry about that shit? Okay. Number 6, follow the money. Followers can be rewarded, and they always are. The most faithful are always rewarded. They're in the early church days, they were oftentimes rewarded with women. They were rewarded with land. They were rewarded with property. Go read the history of the 13th and 14th wards. The 13th and 14th wards were the two, but they were called wards in the early days because they were pure land drawings based on Nauvoo. When they came to Salt Lake, what they did is one of the first things they did, they plotted out the whole valley and then gave these lands. You used to be able to get a map of it at DUP. They've gone a little bit more conservative in the last 20 years, but it's hanging on the wall that you can see how they distributed all the property in 44. The game was over. Salt Lake City was done before anybody came in. And that was so that Young could distribute cherry pieces of land in the 13th and 14th wards as rewards for loyalty, as gifts for those. And as the young women would come in from Scandinavia, I mean, it's been well recorded by many people, that the brethren would scan through and pick the prettiest ones and then farm them out to the brethren or people who had made particular sacrifices. So if you follow the money, you can figure out what's going on. That's what I was saying about Trump and Russia. It doesn't matter about the meetings. It doesn't matter. What matters is the money. And that's why the Trump administration is so ardent about not exposing the transactional data, not the meetings. Because you can position a meeting however you want. But if this Swiss bank account transfers $1 million to this Swiss bank account, the story is there. Okay. The importance of persecution and countering apostasy. You know, people used to ask me, is the church, you know, like tap your lines or follow you around the mall or anything? They don't give two craps about me. I'm an apostate. The church has more experience dealing with apostasy than any other thing they've ever done. I would dare say half of all the people who have joined the church have left. One of my favorite stories you never hear in Sunday school, you know the William Martin Handcart Company, those poor folks who were starving to death and had frostbite and whatnot and rolled into the valley in September, or it was October, I think. There was a group of them. I want somebody to write the history of these folks. In March, at the first break of snow, headed back. These are people who have been starving out on the plains. In March, they left Salt Lake and headed east. Some Mormon historians estimate as many as 50% of everybody who ever came here in a wagon turned around and went back. They don't talk about that in the books much, do they? But my point is the church has been dealing with folks like me for a long time, and they're pretty damn good at it. I don't reach anybody now. I just play Minecraft. But I don't reach the membership. The church is scared of people like John DeLynn, right? The people who are seen as insiders. Those are the ones they really work at. So the importance of persecution and countering apostasy, you can see play out, is as the liberals, the left, increases the venom of their attack. The right has been playing the victim game since at least Newt Gingrich's Republican Revolution in 94. This is a fight. What's happening now has been in the works for 33 years from that group. And they know Fox News and these grew up in this counterculture. They're screwing themselves up because they haven't learned how to govern yet. So they only know how to be counter-government, which is why they're eating themselves right now. But that persecution is absolutely vital to Trump being in power. I have long joked that, and it's not a joke, it's a huge flaw in Mormon theology. The whole thing would have collapsed if one guy had not played his part. If Satan had said, screw you guys, I'm going to go play Minecraft for the next 6,000 years, the whole thing would have fallen, right? The whole entire system was dependent upon this guy who claims he was doing what was done in other worlds, doing what he was supposed to do. All he had to do is not do it. And the whole thing would have fallen on its face. But my point is that you can see even theologically it's built in that we have to have opposition. And the more vehement CNN and the New York Times and Washington Post gets, the more the believers will rally around these things that I've talked about, loyalty and belief and those sort of things. So persecution is playing into their narrative. Donald Trump wants it, and he wants it badly. And Joseph Smith wanted it. And the whole identity, if you sit back and think about the church that you grew up in, is all centered around being a victim. The Mormon church sends out currently 50,000 missionaries with one job, to dismantle, discredit, and steal the members of other religions. You can't get a Mormon to acknowledge that. Think about this. They'll send missionaries into Thailand that has religious and cultural stability for 2,500 years. They will be rejected politely, and they will come back and tell you they're fucking victims. It is the most amazing narrative where you have the most vehemently violent, in terms of cultural violence, religion, probably on the world today, who sees themselves a victim of everything else. It's the same thing with the Christian right today. I mean, they control, like, everything, but they still play themselves as the victims, right? It's built into their narrative, and it's super important. Thank you. The next one is the port in the storm. One thing that we tend to ignore because it's distasteful is the alt-right. And I will define the alt-right as the people who are right, they're conservatives, because they hate the left. That's it. Don't get me wrong, the left does a lot of things that are hateful. I mean, there's a lot of craziness going on out there. I read a great article, they called it the hamburger problem, which is the left needs to stop worrying about what everybody's eating all the time. And they pointed out, and I realized I'd fallen, you know, you can read articles about Donald Trump that he likes KFC. This is not news, and it's not Washington Post level news, and they run those stories. And they run the stories because they do not like Donald Trump. It's not news. And they're doing things like that. The port of the storm is iconoclasm rises in times of uncertainty. And what you're looking at, especially in the Rust Belt, are these people who have strong family values. This is their home. This is their place. And they saw the rise of these communities, the American Dream. And then the companies that were the anchor companies got up and left. They are not quitters. They have family values. They have values in American and hard work, and the work has gone away. What they're looking for is somebody to fix this enormous problem. Those of us in our ivory towers and stuff look at and say, you just got to move to Seattle, man. There's plenty of work there. It's true, but that's not their value. Their value is home. They've been here for 120 years. They do not want to leave. So the problem is much of Trump's followers and much of Smith's followers came because they were rejecting what was happening out there. That they were looking for religion where there was no religion. If you went to Palmyra or in those areas, you had wooden stick churches if you were lucky, and you probably didn't have a trained pastor. And so it was just a homegrown religion. There was a social upheaval at the time of Smith and a social chaos that was happening, much like is happening now. And you see institutions that people rely on failing. And so people are looking for a movement. And what Trump promised is change. What was Obama's campaign? Hope and change, right? It's the same thing. People saying, this system is not working for me. It's failing me. And the fact that there is an elite element of America that says, we don't know what you're talking about, shows you the problem, that they don't go to the flyover states. They don't see this. So the port in the storm is extremely important because Joseph Smith and what he was saying, in a sense, didn't matter. Here was a vibrant community that you could join, and there was love, and there was compassion, there was dancing, and there was singing, and there was joyfulness, and there was a new community, and there was economic growth. The fact that he's spouting out nonsense about cola, but who cares, right? We can see this is working. And the same sort of thing's happening, you know, that Trump does all these things, but he's the first one to really pay attention to the needs of these people, the legitimate needs of these people. So it's any port in a storm. The next one, second to the last, is the rise of supernatural. And it's really a function of some of the other things we've talked about. When you push people who have certain beliefs far enough, and you can show that their beliefs are irrational, they will eventually result to the supernatural. What they will do is fill in that gap with an explanation that defies whatever it is, so you can't trap them anymore, right? I remember a conversation with my father trying to convince him that he couldn't convince me that his emotional responses, some of them were from him and some of them were for God. We were just in an impasse on that because it was a supernatural system that he believed in that I didn't. We didn't speak the same language anymore. So we see this in Trump world. They're starting to imbue Trump with more and more sort of supernatural qualities. And that is this sort of descent from belief on belief, you know, rejection of truth, belief, ultimate loyalty, then supernatural backing of loyalty, because you have to justify that. So the rise of, especially if you read some of the early journals from Smith's followers, they did not, matter of fact, everybody who was alive during Smith's time, they did not talk about the prophet the way we talk about the prophet. Those who knew Joseph Smith didn't consider him to be the kind of quasi-god, a demigod figure that they do now, that because they saw him as a human being, right? And that's why I say it would be scary if Trump were to die for some reason and his believers moved on. The last thing, and I think the most important thing, kind of summing up all these things, timing is everything in these movements. Joseph Smith was a product of his time, and there were people who were hungry for movement, they were hungry for change, they were hungry for community. Those things that when they left their European churches and their enclaves and came here, they left behind. They were interested in building those things back up. After working with ex-Mormons for 15 years, it's their number one lament when they're drunk and quiet in the room. They say, you know, I miss community. I miss that sense of belonging. And when you have a bunch of people who want to belong and there's nothing to belong to, it's any port in a storm, and it will rise up. So Joseph Smith is all about timing. So to kind of put a cap on this, what we see is some of the same elements. The Book of Mormon, The Art of the Deal. You're going to laugh, but it's a best-selling book. It has been for a long time. A lot of people read that thing. You start seeing these grandiose pronouncements. Oh, my God, he's going to lower premiums and give insurance to everybody. He's going to do all this stuff. Then you see the failure of those, and then the retrenchment of, well, they're failing because the liberals are up against him. McConnell had the audacity yesterday to blame the failure of the latest thing on the Democrats when they have completely excluded the Democrats from the process. But it doesn't matter because no one knows that. No one sees that. You know, it's not there. All right, I thought as a final parting gift, I'll give you three things that Joseph Smith should teach us about Donald Trump. So those things we saw are the parallels between the two. And in my mind, what it really does show is that Joseph Smith does not need any supernatural explanation. Donald Trump is not a smart man. I mean, that's very clear. And he doesn't care. You know, when you hear him talk about health insurance, he's never had health insurance. He doesn't understand how the system works at all, right? And he doesn't care. But he still rose to this powerful position. He displays every day vast amounts of ignorance about basic things, right? But it doesn't matter. He wrote a book called The Art of the Deal, which he didn't write. Doesn't matter, right? So Joseph Smith wrote a book of the Book of Mormon. Whether he wrote it or not, there's a lot of people who have different theories. It doesn't matter. He wrote it, and he became the prophet. People joined the religion. And sometimes they did so by wholesale. You know, when they went to Kirtland, they basically just adopted the church that Sidney Rigdon had already built, right? It doesn't matter that he is a demagogue, and he's the demagogue that was needed or desired at that time. And it just so happens that he fulfilled that role. Just like Trump, this parade of errors, which in retrospect can be seen, the infighting, the Republican Party, and different things, he rose to power. But I don't believe Trump did so as much on his own merits as he was the right guy at the right time. So the three things that we all need to learn. One, persecuting the believers has the opposite effect that you want. And ex-Mormons need to get this into their head. The more they push, the more you play into their narrative. And the more the Washington Post and New York Times go low, the more it's going to play into their narrative, and they're going to solidify up. So just remember that with your relatives who are Trump supporters. The more you persecute them for their ignoramus beliefs, the more they're going to circle the wagons. Number two, your opposition has already been accounted for and is necessary. Trump needs your opposition. The best thing that could happen right now is if the left gets bored and walks away and just lets the whole damn thing implode. The third thing is, like I was saying, they will likely bring themselves down. They're their own worst enemy, and they will infight because they're fighters. The Republican Party right now, it doesn't need to be this way, and it will probably reform, is a party of opposition to the government. And now they're in charge. They need opposition. And if the left doesn't supply themselves as opposition, then we see it. They just eat their own. They just turn that vitriol. So bottom line, I think Joseph Smith is a fascinating person that deserves much more research, especially by non-Mormons, than has ever been happened. But I don't think he's that amazing, and I don't think we need divinity to explain him. And I think we really can see that with seeing all of the parallels. There's a bazillion of them. You could write a whole book on the parallels between these two guys. So remember, as you watch Trump, think about Smith and think about what that means for his rise and how he was successful and sort of what we need to do to make sure this country doesn't go in the toilet. All right. That's a terrible place to end this. I think there's one minute. Sorry, I talked a lot. I've been known to do that. If anybody has any question for the wider audience. Yes, sir.
You sort of closed by saying that they'll bring themselves down, and that's something that we can learn from Joseph Smith. But in Joseph Smith's case, he had the opposition of the legal machinery of Nauvoo completely rigged and stacked with his own people that it looked like he would never come down on his own. And so it took kind of a grand vigilante conspiracy to bring him down. And I wonder what you think of that.
Well, let me, I think it's a brilliant point. And let me ask you this question, purely hypothetical. If Joseph Smith had not been assassinated, what would have happened to Mormonism in your view? Chris is brilliant, but I disagree. I think it would have collapsed. And I think your point is well taken, though, because I'm saying leave it alone. But Smith encountered multiple cabinet shakeups of his own, and he weathered those. And in some ways, they were able to use that to prune the disloyal. And they used it as internal purges. The question is, does Trump have enough power in Washington to do that? And I think he did 3 months ago, but I don't think he does now. But fascinating point. Yes, ma'am. Ms.
Last question.
So how come every day we wake up and we have this ritual of making breakfast and watching CNN and all the music and screaming at the people? If something happens and you go, this is it. This is it. This is going to bring down the Trump presidency. This is it. And then it goes away.
Well,
and then another thing happens. And then it goes away. And you keep thinking, what our values, our principles are, does any of it matter? How does it...
What's screwed with all of our minds is the scale of time. Like, it took 3.5 years to bring down Nixon after Watergate. The thing is, there's all these scandals that happened. The lawsuits are all still out there, and they're piling up, and they're going to land. It's not on our time frame. Trump's going to be brought down. The question is, can he start a Reichstag fire before that happens? That's the only question.
Okay, folks, unfortunately, we do have another session coming in that we have to clear out for. So let's give John a big hand.